The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we continue our series from the October 2024 special issue of National Geographic. Now, the theme is the Amazon, described as one of the most important places on Earth. Weather reporting is one of the many scientific endeavors underway in the Amazon Basin. Writer Freddie Wilkinson's article is titled Peak Observations, and he reports that data collected in this high-elevation weather station are revealing the effects of climate change near the headwaters of the Amazon River. So let's learn more as we begin the article. Rising nearly 21,000 feet above the Peruvian plateau, the snowbound Andean summit of Nevado Asangate may seem like a strange place to study the Amazon basin. Yet the frigid peak and its neighbors play a pivotal role in the water cycle, and this region is where insights about climate change and its system-wide impacts are often come into focus, say National Geographic explorers Baker Perry and Tom Matthews. There is a coupling, a relationship between the Amazon and the Andes, Matthews explains. The snow that falls on the tropical Andean peaks comes from water that has evaporated from the leaves of trees in the Amazon. The winds carry it farther west, and this relay keeps going until the clouds make it to the Andes and the water falls as snow, and that snow melts and flows back to the Amazon. In July 2022, Matthews and Perry co-led an expedition to Asangate to place an automated weather station, or AWS, near the summit, one of the highest installations of its kind in the tropical Andes. A 10-foot-high aluminum pole stabilized by tripod legs, the station houses sensors and instruments measuring solar and long-wave radiation, snowfall, temperature, wind speed, and humidity, vital signs that will eventually dictate the pulse of life across the vast riverine landscape far below. Now, getting to the top of Asangate was no joke. The mountain's crux, an almost 650-foot headwall with 70 to 80-degree pitches, demanded technical rope skills, stamina, and a steady mind. It's got longer stretches of verticality than does Mount Everest, on which Matthews and Perry placed a weather station in May 2019. For assistance, the scientists turned to Quechuan and Aymara guides from Peru and Bolivia, as well as members of the Colitas Escaladoras, a mountaineering club of Aymara women who climb in traditional dress. National Geographic explorer Ruth Mary Pilco Huacaya also joined the team, as did scientists from universities in Cusco and La Paz and Peru's National Service of Meteorology and Hydrology. For Perry, who grew up in Peru and Bolivia and later played professional basketball in Bolivia, the expedition felt like a homecoming. The AWS installation began to yield results right away. Initial findings indicate eyebrow-raising levels of solar radiation on the summit, and forest fires in the Amazon produce black carbon, which, combined with bright sunlight, can have serious implications for Asangate's glacial ice. The more black carbon on the snow, the more of the sun's energy is absorbed. That results in more melting, Perry explains. Thanks to cloud reflectivity, it's routinely brighter at Asangate than it is on the edge of the atmosphere in near space. The sunshine, Matthews says, is extraordinary. Well, among the issues being addressed in the Amazon basin, as we continue to explore, I think I'm going to read this article next. I'm going to switch something here. The Hidden Headwaters of the Amazon, and Jordan Salamas has a story about this because this ties into what we just read. No one knows this place, he says. It's about the remote origins of Bolivia's secure river harbor, described as a natural paradise. So let's learn more about these headwaters, okay? Nestled within Esebaro Secure National Park, an indigenous territory where the Andean foothills meet the lowland rainforest in Bolivia, is a place so difficult to assess that few humans until recently have ever set foot there. The Simane, Mojeño, Trinitario, and Yaracare indigenous groups have hunted and fished the lowlands for millennia. But locals say that in living memory, nobody has ventured upstream to the headwaters of the Sucuri River, an Amazon tributary. Now, no one knows this place, says Royser Irby, a member of the Yaracare community. You cannot get there by canoe. It's very risky, and the water is very fast, he said. The jungle defends itself with thunder, with heavy rain, with wind, and with lightning, agreed Felix Urbamosa, Royser's cousin and the mayor of La Asunta, the nearest Simante settlement to the headwaters. There was always fear of dangerous animals, too. That's why our ancestors never went to these places, he added. Now, this hidden corner holds a stunning amount of wildlife. Neotropical otters ply rivers thick with fish. Capybaras rest in brush and macaws perch in the trees. Jaguar tracks crisscross the riverbanks. Animals like the South American tapir, famously elusive, shows unusually naive behavior around people. You get the sense that you're in a place unlike anywhere else, says Guido Miranda, a biologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. There is no evidence whatsoever of the presence of humans, he adds. It's also the only place in the Amazon basin where National Geographic photographer Thomas Peschek found such clear water. A two-year search covering eight countries led him to an Argentine fly fisherman named Marcelo Perez, an owner of Untamed Angling. Now, the outfitter has been running the catch-and-release trips along the lower reaches of the Isabero Siquero Park's rivers with special permission from Bolivian authorities, arranging a profit-sharing partnership with Simane, Mojeño, Trinitario, and Yaracare people to encourage conservation. Now, in 2021, Perez began to fly helicopters to the hidden headwaters for the first time, and in 2022, he invited Peschek to join him. The headwaters did not disappoint. The water's clarity allowed Peschek to capture some of the first-ever underwater images of this extraordinary place. Hundreds of giant pacu, a cousin of the piranha, schooled around him. He swam alongside human-sized catfish and the stunning golden dorado. I've gone up and down the maps, I've had a look for similar sorts of geographical systems, and I've spoken to literally hundreds of people, Peschek says, but I've not come across anything equivalent to this. Nothing. You hop in the water there, and it's like you're in the ocean. You cannot believe you're in the Amazon River. Well, while Perez's outfitter now regularly runs trips by helicopter to the area during the dry season, the hidden headwaters of Isabella Siquiri has not yet been scientifically surveyed, and biologists are eager to start. Without a doubt, there could be a new species, said Miranda. Those who have been in the place for themselves hope it might become a national treasure, for Bolivians and protected from future exploitation. I'm proud that my community has this landscape, said Royce Irby. It should be kept exactly how it is. Wow. Quite a story there, isn't it? Okay. Well, now, among the issues being addressed in the Amazon basin is mining. Now, measuring the impact of mining is the theme of Thomas Peschek's article. We just read about Thomas and his ability to photograph these regions. Goals Unseen Cost is the title of his article, and as the subhead that's accompanying the article says, as prospecting raises parts of the Amazon, researchers investigating the damage look for ways to bring about the best possible future for the rainforest. So let's learn some more now as we study this Goals Unseen Coast. Peru's Madre de Rios region is lush and biodiverse, but the quest for gold is reshaping it. Miners clear-cut swaths of rainforest and sift the soil for precious metal. When they've exhausted the location's potential for gold, they've exhausted its soil as well and altered the flow of local waterways. The miners move on to other areas while the terrain they leave behind languishes, strewn with sand mounds and contaminated ponds. Now a trio of National Geographic explorers are aiming to mitigate the damage. For more than 2 years, Josh West, Henspeak Adelia Quellez, and Jennifer Angel Amaya have been examining the environmental consequences of gold mining in Madre de Dios and developing strategies for reducing pollution at these sites and later revitalizing them. The mined areas may never revert to rainforest, but perhaps they can be healthy in a different form, such as wetlands. Now, an environmental scientist at the University of Southern California, West uses drones equipped with LIDAR, laser-based remote sensing, and thermal imaging cameras, as well as electrical resistivity tomography, a method of injecting current underground to learn where water is present. He and his research group are characterizing how deforestation has changed the landscape in its ecosystem, including how water moves through it. They're finding, he says, that water ends up in all the wrong places. Cadillo Cuarez, or Cuarez, a native of Peru and a microbial ecologist at Arizona State University, focuses on Earth's smallest and by far most abundant organisms. Normally, microbes consume carbon and methane, removing them from the environment. But in degraded soil, like that at mined sites, they can instead release greenhouse gases. Cadillo Quiroz is examining the relationship among microbes, plants, and heat-trapping emissions. For Angel Amaya, mercury is the target. Now, she's measuring and mapping the distribution of the toxic metal, which is widely used in the region's gold mining industry. Now, a geologist and a Ph.D. student in environmental science at Columbia University, Angel Amaya is also testing a device for determining whether gold was extracted without mercury. If a market develops for mercury-free gold, it could draw higher-paying consumers and incentivize producers to eliminate the toxin. Now, local communities are integral. Cadillo Cuarez calls them the other half of our team, and with their participation and with insights gleaned from the data, these scientists believe that mining sites might adapt and start to reclaim the visceral feeling of life that West says is especially palpable in the Amazon. So there we have some very interesting information about mining and some of the impacts that it's having there. And, of course, there is a graphic that accompanies this particular article, and I want to share it with you. It highlights some of the impact of gold mining. First of all, thousands of years of Andean erosion have deposited tiny flecks of gold in the river basin. Now, miners turn up sites to find the precious metal using destructive extraction and refining practices. Now, extracting flecks, sediments are dredged from rivers and banks and then sluiced, yielding a metal-rich concentrate. Then we have this process called binding gold. Liquid mercury is added to the concentrate to bind and form clumps with gold particles. Hence, there's the mercury injection, and obviously a question raised about its environmental usefulness there. And then we have isolating gold. Processes such as distilling are safer, but clumps can be burned, often releasing toxic mercury vapor into the environment. So there you have a pretty good idea of what's going on. And by the way, the Amazon imbalance is the title of this graphic, and I'll just read a brief caption. It says, inhabited by humanity for millennia, the Amazon basin is under increasing pressure as development drives ever deeper into remote forests. Leading threats outlined here have the potential to permanently harm fragile ecosystems. Illicit activity exacerbates these problems and disrupting conservation efforts in the lives of those who call the Amazon home. Next, a Brazilian ecologist, João Campos Silva, learns what he doesn't know from the Ribeirinhos, or the river people of the Amazon. So he's going to kind of tell us about this culture called the river people. His article is called Lessons in the Flooded Forest, and we begin. In my work among Brazil's lowlands, halfway between the Andes and the sea, this is how I've come to think of Araucapama, which is also known as the Pararucu, from indigenous word for fish in red. And as the headline says here, a fish, a giant prehistoric-looking fish, is a window into the complexity of the Amazon. Now more. Araucapamas' heads are gray-green, but red scales spread down their backs and brighten at peak mating readiness as though eliminated from within. There are so many startling things I can tell you about the arapaima, that it breathes air, for example, and must keep splashing up at the water's surface to inhale, that its huge scales are tough as armor, that its skin makes a fine leather for costly purses and shoes. That one boneless arapaima steak can weigh 150 pounds. It's the biggest scaled freshwater fish in the world. I once included in a science article a photo of a fishing family with an arapaima they had caught, one boy at the tail, another at the gills. Nine people stood beside this thing along a single stretched-out fish. If I could transport you through the region to the place where the photo on this page was taken, and he has a picture of him beside one of these waterways, where I learned to see the arapaima story as a model for a truly sustainable Amazonia, we would make our way around by boat. We'd have to, because in the Vaseia, the lowland forest of the river basin, the transport routes are waterways, and seasonal rains raise surface levels to heights that would be catastrophic elsewhere. 30-foot floods, 40-foot floods, normal. Now, stream and lake boundaries vanishing beneath the high water and reappearing as it recedes, normal. Picture a sumama, or kapok, the great emblematic tree of the river basin, with fish swimming against or past branches that just a few months earlier held songbirds. Around the Huara River, one of the many tributaries winding through the river basin before feeding into the Amazon, houses are built atop stilts. Local families travel by canoe and often with outboard motors. Bigger motorboats carry goods, fuel, and passengers who bring hammocks on board so they can hang them from hooks and relax. The Hialeah, the workboat our Instituto Huara uses to move between the research sites, is also our mobile field office, kitchen, and hammocks again, sleeping quarters. So we'd assign you a hammock space, and we'd pull out of a Karari, the riverside town with a little airport you can fly into. It takes the Hialeah about 3 days to go up the zigzagging Huara to reach the spot where we drop anchor. We're still in transit, though, into canoes now, and then another few hours motoring up streams until the first sight of colorful houses and wooden boardwalks. And finally, because this is the village I think you'd like to see first, the main dock at São Raimundo. Now, my biology doctorate is from Brazil's Universidade Federal de Rio Grande do Norte, but in the Recife, São Raimundo and other communities nearby have been my true university. Like other examples of the world's apex megafauna, large animals at the top of their food chains, the arapaima not long ago was headed for extinction here in its native habitat. It was Huara, the Ribeiranos people of the river, who taught me how to they brought their megafish back from the brink, a lesson for all Amazonia. Now, I believe, and maybe for the first future of the biodiversity of the planet, those of us working in conservation live with too much grief these days, and around the Huara, I can see a feedback loop we don't encounter enough in this imperiled piece of the world. People sustaining nature, nature sustaining people, a spot of hope. I pray every day I will come to know Amazonia. I want to work there when I grow up. I wrote in the 1992 when I was nine. My mother had given me a book about wildlife of Amazonia, which was so far from our southeastern Brazil home that we might as well have been on another continent. I fell in love then, and permanently, it seems. That third grader's declaration became the preface, a quarter century later, to my Ph.D. thesis about the Amazonian arapaima. Now, partly about the arapaima, really, though, my thesis, like all my work since then, was devoted to the Ribeiranos, who live there where the arapaimas do. Now, these fish have a very long history on the continent. They breathe there because they evolved millions of years ago in the shallow, low-oxygen lake, then covering what is now the Amazon River Basin. We have archaeological evidence of the region's peoples eating arapaima long before Europeans invaded, and arapaimas appear in some indigenous peoples' cosmologies. It remains a fish of tremendous cultural and economic value. Arapaima is an important part of the local diet, and generations of fishing families have depended on income from the sale of its meat and skin. Arapaima is also a popular delicacy in other parts of Brazil, which is what helped bring it to near extinction. Both within and outside Amazonia are cities whose populations have exploded in recent decades, and by the 1990s, as more and more outsiders, technically sophisticated commercial boats, were working the Juarez rivers to meet the growing demand in restaurants and homes, everyone could see what was happening to the catch. In many lakes that had once served as nurseries and harvest sites, the Arapamas were gone. For Ribeirão villages, fishing collapse means disaster for the whole community. Families were losing both their income and their daily protein. Overfishing depleted the supply of smaller food fish as well. There was something else, too, in that the Ribeirinhos helped me see when I began spending time in the Bacia. Regardless of what national data might define as an economic poverty line, they told me they did not regard themselves or their culture as impoverished. The natural world around them helped create the life they wanted for their children, they said, and hanging on to that was perhaps the most critical thing of all. They talked to me outdoors, the leaders sitting together on the boardwalks, teaching me about their lives. Even as a Brazilian, I was such a foreigner when I first came to Amazonia. My formal education had taken place in the very competitive environment of conventional modern science. Now I was obliged to say to villagers that I had just met, "Thank you for insisting I take your sleeping room tonight while you move your hammock outdoors, but no, please just show me where to go hang mine." I had never experienced such generosity. I had to practice slowing down, quieting myself, and simply listening. And it was from the Ribeirinhos that I learned the backstory and details of the powerful accords that completely changed Arapaima fishing. 2 decades ago, across the swath of Bacia, we scientists called the Mid-Juara, or 4 million acres of Amazonian floodplain. Combining scientific and traditional knowledge, the government-backed Mamarua Institute for Sustainable Development in 1999 helped work out innovative rules which are enforced to this day. As a result, most of the community lakes were closed to outsider boats. A few were kept open for recreational and commercial fishing, but on the protected lakes, villagers built floating guardhouses they occupy in shifts, often armed with shotguns to keep poachers away. Local fishermen agreed to strict limits on their own harvests, which now take place only once a year over 5 intense days. Fishing accords to conserve game and wildlife are familiar to many of us, I know. But what pulled me into the Mid-Juara communities was the way this conservation plan, the Arapaima model, has made shared bounty its centerpiece. It's not coincidental that some of the Juara leaders are from the Amazonian rubber tapper families. Their relatives were part of a defiant movement that a half century ago began organizing tappers, the workers who extract latex from living trees. The tappers drew international attention to the threatened rainforest as the trees they depended upon were being burned away to make room for cattle and to the semi-enslavement conditions in which most of the tappers worked. Those tapper campaigns were difficult, sometimes violent. The most famous of the organizers, Chico Mendes, was murdered in 1988 by a cattle rancher, but they helped bring about Amazonia's first extractive reserves, government-protected forest, areas managed by and for the benefit of the people who live there. That's the idea behind the Arapaima model, which so far has produced spectacular, well-documented results. Researchers estimate an almost 600% increase in much of the protected area, with the brief harvest now yielding hundreds of fish. In the villages that Instituto Juara studies and studies with, the dividing of the haul is led by the families and a Ribeirinhos organization called ASPROC, ASPROC, the Association of Rural Producers of Charharre. Now, there is no private middleman. Keep in mind the size of an adult Arapaima and those 150-pound slabs of fish meat. Earnings stay in the villages now, with group decisions about how that money will be used. The Arapaima lakes function as community savings banks. We see the results every time we visit. New solar panels, medical care, boat motors, social organizations, happiness. And this, I believe, is the way to restore and protect the natural resources of Amazonia by recognizing that one of its natural resources is people. Look, when I was studying conservation science, I encountered a school of thought that regarded nature and wild and fragile places as something to be shielded from humans. Let's take the people out idea. Let's put up walls to keep nature pristine. But Amazonia, wild and fragile as it is, has been inhabited by humans for at least 13,000 years. I'm part of a movement insisting that any plan to help conserve it, the forest, rivers, animals, and birds, must begin by listening to traditional knowledge and the needs of its rural communities, and including them in the decision-making. For what if we call conservation cannot bring a better life for them, then conservation is a fallacy. Instituto Huala, both studies and works with the Ribeirão communities, documenting benefits from community-based conservation for people and nature. But the challenges are enormous. The market doesn't fairly compensate local communities. If this model is to spread, we'll need global support. Multi-government fund, perhaps to ensure economic stability for places like Sao Raimundo, for people working to keep their land healthy. We need to ask a very fair question. If the world really wants to sustain Amazonia, who is willing to pay? When I first came to Amazonia 16 years ago, the river basin and the people there made me feel like a child or an empty glass waiting to be filled. Most of the time, especially when I'm driving the Hialeah, remember that's his boat, that feeling stays with me. That is my favorite place to think, standing at the Hialeah's helm. I'm wrestling problems in my mind, and sometimes the boat is slow or the river's low, and on this water you cannot be rushed. Patience, humility. Ribeirão's taught me that. Very good story there, right? We're going to wrap up things today with an article by Hicks Wogan. By the way, before I do that, writer Cynthia Gurney, an editor for the National Geographic, helped with the story we just read, and I want to give her credit. Now we're going to move on to Rick Hogan's article, The Underwater Woods. He tells the story of two scientists who monitored the flood pressure in low-elevation Amazonian forest in race to protect them from increasing environmental schemes. He writes, of the 2.3 million square miles that make up the Amazon rainforest, more than 320,000 are low-lying wetlands that can survive both above the waterline. Every year, the rainy season inundates these areas with up to 40 feet of floodwater peaking in May or June, subsiding by October or November. Trees there have to fight to live, either by adapting to the water or wading it out. For National Geographic explorer Diego Sana Fiado Silva, this makes the flooded forest more interesting. By comparison, terrestrial forests are boring, right? He jokes. They have everything they need. And so he goes on to say about the human activity can disrupt the Amazon's flood pattern, and the explorers are preparing to forecast scenarios and support conservation efforts. Silva also plans to turn his LIDAR scans, he uses LIDAR for part of his research, into virtual reality experience that's going to place users inside the wetland so they can get used to what's going on there. And he hopes to see this remote ecosystem up close, and as he and Tavares do their work, will help build the public understanding about its care and survival. What a story, right? Well, that's going to do it for today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it. We're going to have more on this special issue from National Geographic about the Amazon in a future report. We hope you'll join us. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler, available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.